This is a fraught topic to speak about. It's a complicated topic to speak about because by definition, speaking about it will not be equally relevant to every one of my listeners or every one of my hearers. And sometimes we as a community, in our desire not to say things that can potentially cause pain, don't say things that need to be said. So we can't talk about married life because there are people in the audience who still have not married, and that might be something that's difficult or painful for them. And we can't talk about having kids because there are people in the audience who haven't yet had kids, and that's something that's difficult or painful for them. And we can't talk, but sometimes there are things we need to talk about, and so we need to say, I had the opportunity this summer, and it was a wonderful opportunity actually, to teach the Wexner Graduate Fellowship. So the Wexner Graduate Fellowship is a very prestigious fellowship for young, up-and-coming Jewish educators, cantors, rabbis, people going to all kinds of Jewish communal work. They are a very impressive cohort, much more impressive than I was when I was their age. And I was invited to speak and teach them, and I discovered something very interesting. It was really my first experience being in a pluralistic Jewish setting. I've been in non-Jewish settings extensively in college and graduate school, but I had never been in a setting that was exclusively Jewish, but across all denominations, backgrounds, and everything else. And what you find going on there is this kind of inevitable self-censorship in which nobody wants to give offense to anybody else, whether it's to the right, to the left, or in whatever other direction, and so you keep pulling back and not saying things, and I found myself, you know, the first 2 hours kind of making fun of it, and then by 4 hours in, I'm doing it also. And then I had to sort of push back against that tendency not to actually say what I think out of fear that maybe somebody else doesn't think it in the fine defensive. So all of this is by way of a very long introduction to say that I ask you to listen generously. And if I say something that's not relevant to you in your life right now, hear an understanding that it's relevant to someone else in their life right now. And more importantly, I think these are things that we as a community need to think about, deal with, and address. And not to walk away saying, how could she assume that all people? I don't assume that all people. I don't assume that all women. But nevertheless, these are big issues in our community, issues that need addressing and issues I want to talk about. So, let's talk about the problem. Before we decide to talk about any approaches to thinking about solutions, let's talk about the problem. Okay? For some of you, you are in the stage of life where you are in the thick of the problem. For some of you, you are looking forward to that being your problem, although it is not your problem yet. And for those of you who are at the stage of being mothers or mothers-in-law or grandmothers-in-law of people who are in the midst of the problem, it is important for you to understand what the problem looks like and to understand how your daughters and daughters-in-law and granddaughters and granddaughters-in-law are living different lives and dealing with different issues than you did when you were at the same stage of life. So, what do we, big we, again, understanding it's not going to be the same we for everybody, but what do we, big we, expect of ourselves as from women? Well, we have to have a career that contributes to our family finances. That's a non-negotiable. Whether or not that also provides us with a personal sense of meaning or personal fulfillment or intellectual challenge, that's another question. We have to have kids, preferably lots of kids, which means going through years, decades of our lives, dealing with the physical demands of childbearing and child rearing. Of course, we have to maintain an organized and smoothly functioning home. We have an expectation of ourselves that we daven, that we learn, that we maintain our own meaningful relationship with God in the midst of all of this. We should be working on having a loving, passionate, and growth-oriented marriage, right? Date night, anybody? We should be cooking and serving on a regular basis meals that your average American makes exactly once a year, and it takes them 3 weeks to prepare for and 3 weeks to recover from, right? If you read any of the women's magazines around Thanksgiving, it is absolutely mind-blowing. They are like getting ready for D-Day to serve one Yom Tov meal. You're like, honey, on 3-day Yom Tov, I serve six of those. And when it took us 7 days later, I serve another six of those, right? And they're like getting ready to launch Operation Overlord to get the Thanksgiving turkey onto the table. Of course, we're supposed to do all of that while eating right, exercising, and maintaining the same figure we had when we were 22.
We're supposed to be mindfully, thoughtfully, intentionally parenting our children, not just screaming at them, I told you, da, 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 right? Not supposed to do that anymore. And as we move from the beginning of this stage of life into the later stage of this stage of life, we can be dealing with everything from our own kids' shidduchim to increasingly our parents' need for looking out for and care all at the same time. I said to somebody recently, this just came up a year or two ago, that I realized I was at a very big turning point in my life when I was spending more time nagging my mother than she was spending nagging me. Did you take care of this? And are you taking care of her? Are you making sure that you're taking care of yourself in the ways you need to be taken care of? I was spending more time nagging my mother than she was spending nagging me, and that was a major turning point in my life. And then, it's orange day in kindergarten. I have to make sure that Yosef has a clean orange shirt to wear. And next week it's going to be red day followed by green, purple, pink, and what if my three-year-old doesn't have t-shirts in a Crayola array of colors? Mazel tov, she is engaged. Now there's the small chaim just for the family, the vart, the shower, the Shabbos kala, the wedding, and the Shabbos shava brachas. A very special person is giving a shir in my community. I really should go hear her. All right, work. That thing that I pretend to do when I'm not doing everything else. The boss wants me to travel for work to D.C., to L.A., to China. We are asking of ourselves the impossible. We cannot do it, not because we cannot do it, but because it cannot be done. There is simply not enough hours in the day, enough days in the week, enough time in our lives. There is not enough emotional and enough physical energy to do every one of those things and do them as well as they are supposed to be done. We individually are not falling short. We individually are asking of ourselves to do that which cannot be done. So how do we get here? That's the problem. Step one is what's the problem. Step two is how do we get to this place where this is what we're asking of ourselves, that which cannot be done. And then we'll talk about a few things that we can maybe start to do to address this. How did we get here? We got here through an interesting combination of holding on to some things that come to us through traditional Judaism, holding on to some things that come to us through a reinvention of traditional Judaism, even though our great-grandmothers and great-great-grandmothers were not doing these things, and holding on to some things that are the product of the feminist revolution and then its descendants over the past 40 or so years. And combining all of those different demands into an aggregate in which we are expecting ourselves the most demanding things of a contemporary life, the most demanding things of a traditional life, and then a few extra things just thrown in for good measure. So let's talk about a few of those things that come into the mix to get us to where we are. For no particular reason, I'll start with the history of technology. My actual academic background, when I had one, was in the history of science. That's sort of long since behind me. I haven't done that for a while. But we'll start with reference to the history of technology. There's an excellent book by a woman named Ruth Schwartz Cohen called More Work for Mother. She talks about the fact that as you look at the 20th century, and really particularly the post-war, the 20th century wave of inventions, of appliances, of time-saving technology, you would expect to start seeing women with so much more free time on their hands, right? I don't have to wring the laundry in the old-fashioned wringer machine. I can toss my laundry into the washing machine, and then when I'm done, I can toss it into the dryer. I don't have an ice box, so I can only keep, you know, whatever, one day's worth of milk around at a time. I have a 22 cubic foot freezer, and I can buy 20 gallons of milk and freeze them and go shopping once every, I don't know how frequently, right? I don't have to sweep my floor with a straw broom. I have my handy-dandy vacuum. And she talks about why it is, therefore, that we don't see the amount of housework that women do decrease. In fact, if anything, it seems to go up. The hours is measured over the
course of the period that she's studying, the number of hours of housework seem to increase, not decrease, despite the advent of enormous numbers of time-saving technologies.
And she says something which, as soon as you hear it, you're like, oh, of course, that's obvious, but of course, sometimes you need somebody to point out the obvious, which is, as the technology available to do stuff increases, our demands of ourselves increase. When you took the laundry down to the river and beat it on the rocks, I won't tell you how frequently they wash their linen, because it'll make your skin crawl, but it wasn't once a week, right? You weren't changing clothing with the frequency that we change clothing. You weren't washing things with the frequency that we wash things. You had much less stuff, and you had very different expectations for how that stuff would be kept and managed, because you were spending so much of your time baking bread every day. And now we're not baking bread every day, but instead our expectations of ourselves in other areas of home maintenance are such that we've simply filled the time with other things. So one answer as to why we find ourselves in the position we find ourselves in is because despite the advent of all kinds of time-saving technologies, we are concomitantly upping the level of demands of ourselves to keep up with and even exceed the time that's saved by the technologies. The reality of the need for two earner families, and that's a need that's driven by everything from years in Colwell to the realities of tuition and the expenses of a contemporary Orthodox life, which means certainly not for all families, but for many families, having two parents work is an absolute necessity. And that the 1950s vision of the middle class family that could be supported on dad's salary while mom stayed home with the kids is just not a reality for many, many people in our world anymore. If you start to do the math on how much money you have to bring in order to reasonably afford an Orthodox life, and by reasonably afford, I exclude from that calculus sukkahs in Israel and Pesach in Arizona, you find that it is a very expensive life indeed, and it takes a lot of earning power to make that life happen. The influence of feminism in our religious lives, and that's an interesting thing to think about, because I think we sometimes think about feminism in contrast or in contradiction to Orthodoxy, and I think that's a very oversimplified and often erroneous way to think about it. Many, probably most, many people of our great-grandmothers expected engagement, I know there are exceptions, but many, most, expected engagement with religious life to be the province of their husbands, and they stayed home with the kids. Until the advent of widespread education for Jewish women in the beginning of the 20th century, there were plenty of Jewish women who couldn't read Hebrew. There were women in shul who would recite line of tefillot, and women would say the zugot, and somebody would say it, they would say it after, because they couldn't necessarily read the siddur. They davened or learned in Yiddish, right? They were not necessarily literate in Hebrew. And there were probably much lower expectations in terms of their own level of religious engagement. Certainly there were much lower expectations in terms of their own level of religious learning. As a product of the feminist revolution that says girls should be educated as boys are, girls should be meaningful participants in Judaism as boys are, women should be meaningful participants in Judaism as men are, we expect of ourselves, while we're juggling all the other things that we're juggling, that we also find time to learn, that we also find time to go out and hear that shir, that we also find time to go to shul and daven. I should be very clear about the fact that I do not think this is a bad thing. I think the greater involvement of 50% of the Jewish people in Judaism over the past however many decades is one of the great positive developments for Judaism. But nevertheless, it imposes another burden on us that our great-grandmothers didn't have. They had the burden of the kids. They didn't have the burden also of figuring out how to have meaningfully engaged religious lives while they're having kids. Well, yes, I will repeat the question. The question was, how do I square that with Sarah Schneer, who was not trying to give the girls an education comparable to what the boys were given. She was simply observing the fact that the girls, in the absence of any Torah education, were abandoning the fold and was therefore looking to give them the Torah education that they needed to stay in the fold. There's a long conversation to be had about the way Sarah Schneerer is generally portrayed within the Beis Yaakov movement and the sort of historical Sarah Schneerer. The historical Sarah Schneerer is a woman who goes from Eastern Europe, okay, to Western Europe and hears the teachings of the German-educated Hirschian ideas that are available, right? She hears those teachers teaching her and is inspired by those ideas and seeks to bring her precious Torah back to the girls of Eastern Europe. Now, it's certainly true she wasn't teaching Torah Shebaal Peh, by and large. She's not a, you know, it's anachronistic, obviously, to say she's a feminist in any kind of 1970s or 2015 kind of way. She wasn't. But nor was she simply saying, it's not quite accurate to say she was simply saying, let's teach them the halachos they need to know to keep Shabbos properly. And she was educating them in a sophisticated and thinking way about how to be Jewish women in the contemporary world. And then remember, she was sending them out at a ridiculously young age to be entrepreneurs in Torah, to go out on their own and start schools in wherever. Not exactly your traditional stay at home until you get married and move into you. And of course, it's important to remember that Sarah Schneerer herself, her own family life, was quite non-traditional. Non-traditional. She was married younger, divorced, married again later to a man whose name she did not take. She kept her own last name. And was very much doing the work she was doing. Now, again, I think it's, I strongly object to doing anachronistic things like saying, well, Sarah Schneerer was the first feminist, whatever. Sarah Schneerer was doing this in her world on her terms.
Can I just add something?
Yes.
She wanted to give them an intellectual output so that they will not go to the colleges, so that this was an intellectual thing, not necessarily teach them more religious, more observant, give them something because they were absolutely starved for intellectual ideas. So this is one way that she had of giving something to them.
And of course, Sarah Schneerer giving women an intellectual outlet, not simply sort of practical training they needed. And of course, her right-hand men and women were a very interesting and very highly educated. You're talking about Dr. Judith Grunfeld, and these are not, your sort of retiring Beis Yaakov students, as you might think of them today. If it's okay with you, I'm going to try to move a little bit forward, and I will very much hope we have time for questions, but I'd at least like to get through how we got here, and then a couple of things I think we might do, and then I know this is a topic, since I feel like this is a topic that I could talk about for 3 hours, I assume it's a topic that many of you feel like you could talk about for a long time. So, feminism in our religious lives, our expectations, and then I will say, more broadly, cultural influences from the 21st century world that we live in, but cultural influences that are being shaped by people whose lives don't look anything like ours. So, for example, it's interesting to me because there's a ton of stuff being written about this in the broader world, right? A ton of stuff about work-life balance, a ton of stuff about the demands on women. I've read a lot of it, by no means all of it, everything from Anne-Marie Slaughter's famous article in The Atlantic, Why Women Can't Have It All, Deborah Spar, the president of Barnard College, which is a book called Wonder Woman, Sex, Power, and the Quest for Perfection, Naomi Wolf's book, Misconceptions, which is more than a decade old at this point, but dealing with their own experiences, having kids, and on and on and on, we could go on all day. And all these women are talking about how difficult it is to pull off this balancing act. And of course, when I talk to my friends and my sisters about it, they all say they think they have it hard. They're trying to pull off this balancing act, right, with two kids, with three kids. They're trying to pull off this balancing act with no religious expectations of themselves. They're trying to pull off this balancing act without Shabbos and Yom Tov. And yet, the things that make the balancing act so hard for them, we have taken into our world and our expectations for ourselves, even as all those other things are in play. So, for example, I talked about this before. My mother says, when she had kids, and certainly when she was a kid, parent was a noun, it wasn't a verb, right? Parent was a noun, it was not a verb. You were a parent, you didn't parent. right? I have many sisters and many friends who have taken very extensive parenting classes. There's a Rebbetzin in Eretz Yisrael, there's a psychologist in Muncie, you sign up, you do however many hours of online and phone conference, you get a workbook this fat. Clearly I'm the bad parent because I haven't done that. But every word that comes out of your mouth and every interaction with your children is supposed to be eisgecheshben and thought through and planned and right and exactly, right? Now, those burdens, those models of parenting sometimes are coming from a world in which you're not trying to do that while you're having the number of kids that you're having and all the other expectations and burdens on yourself. The whole insanity around food consumption among us into our mouths. I am as big a believer as you are, I promise you, in eating healthy food. I am as big a believer as you are in cutting down on sugar. But the almost obsessive tone this has taken on in the broader world, the extent to which that comes into our world, and now on top of everything else, we can be sitting in our heads in that all day. The school I used to work in, SAR, once brought in a psychologist who deals with eating disorder issues within the FRM community. And she spoke about something that she says that exists, to a very great extent within the FRM community, which is not just eating disorders as such, but something she calls orthorexia. And orthorexia in that case doesn't mean like orthodox. It means what orthodox also means, which is right or correct. This obsessive focus on right or correct eating, which she says can reach the point where it itself borders on being an eating disorder. So we're supposed to be... The itself borders on being an eating disorder. That we're so obsessively focused on the rightness of what we eat and what we serve and what our kids eat, that we've gotten to the point. There's an historian at Cornell University named Joan Jacobs Brumberg who has studied eating disorders extensively. And in one of her books has an insight that is like so fascinating and terrifying. Once you hear it and once you take that in, it changes how you think about many of the conversations you engage in with other women. As part of her study of teenage girls and their eating habits, she read many girls' diaries from the late 19th century and again from the late 20th century. And she says when you look at girls' resolutions in late 19th century diaries, they say things like, I must be better. I must be more respectful to my mother. I must be kinder to other people. I must stop gossiping. I must be better. And when you look at late 20th century diaries of teenage girls, they say, I must be better. I must cut out sweets. I must lose 5 pounds. I must drop a dress size. I must be better. All right, she says, and again, this is a secular woman writing in a secular world, but how much has that way of thinking about things penetrated our? The definition of what it means to be good is, I was so good, I didn't have that piece of cake, right? That's the definition of what it means to be good. And again, Joan Jacobs Brumberg is writing about this in a much broader world, but it is as true, if not truer. And of course, the twin and conflicting, set the yumptive table, put out all the food, have the 8 courses, have the 6th layer with the ganache and the cream and this and the that dessert, but you be good, don't eat. And so we're just talking about how we got to where the problem is and all the different things we are taking in, the necessities, the cultural influences, the desire for ourselves to be religiously meaningfully engaged, and all of this creates this impossible hodgepodge of expectations for ourselves. I want to read you what Deborah Spahr, again, the president of Barnard College. She's an economist by training. She spent many years as a professor of economics at the Harvard Business School, which is a notoriously not warm and fuzzy place. Now she's the president of Barnard College, and she just published this book. I have to say, I read her interview in the New York Times, which I included a chunk of in your sources, and the interview was so good that I got the book. kind of disappointed in the book. She basically had about one chapter or two chapters worth of really smart and insightful things to say, and then she padded the rest of the book with another, you know, six or eight chapters worth of blah, 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 because one or two smart chapters does not a book make. And she put the one or two smart chapters at the end after you read through a lot of blah, blah, blah. But I will read you sort of the money graph, as they say. The result of these conflicting pressures is a force field of highly unrealistic expectations. Almost by definition, a woman cannot work 60-hour week in a high-stress job and be the same kind of parent she would have been without a 60-hour week and all that stress. She cannot save the world and look forever like a 17-year-old model or bake a perfect cheesecake the night before a major presentation. No man can do this. No human can do this. Yet women are repeatedly berating themselves for failing at this kind of balancing act and quietly, invidiously berating others when something inevitably slips. Think of the schadenfreude that erupts every time a high-profile woman hits a bump in either her career or her family life. Poor Condoleezza Rice, left without a boyfriend. Sloppy Hillary, whose hair is wrong again. She could not pull it off, snicker, snicker. She paid for her success. She could not do it all. Of course she could not do it all. No one can. No one does. Yet women today are laboring under an excruciating set of mutually exclusive expectations, a double or triple whammy of hopes and dreams and desires. And again, the really smart stuff goes on for a couple of pages, so take the book out of the library, read the last two chapters. So what do we do about this? I wanted, the hour is getting late, and I do not mean for this to just be a bemoaning of where we are. I do not think we are stuck saying we are stuck and bemoan where we are. I think there is more that we can do about that, and I'd like us to start thinking about how to do it for ourselves and for the community of women that we are a part of. For our sisters, for our daughters and daughters-in-law and granddaughters and granddaughters-in-law, for our friends, for everybody who's part of the community of women that we are part of, to create and shape a community. So what do we do? The very first thing I think we do is that we acknowledge the reality that we can't do it all. No one does it all, and we stop telling what I call in the position of micro stories, right? Wonder worker stories. Don't tell miracle stories about the miracle woman who does it all. There are a couple of reasons not to tell these stories. First of all, I am a skeptic. I do not believe in the miracle woman who does it all. A big reason I don't believe in that is because to some people, I am that woman. And I know, because they say to me, how do you do it all? Right? I have a demanding career with a public role. I'm supposedly the representative of children who are better poorly with many hundreds of congregants. I have five kids. My husband is a communal role. How do I do it all? The answer is, I do not. I used to say to people, if I carried my living room around on my back like a snail, you would know that I don't do it all, because you would see what a mess it is all the time. But I walk out of the house, and all I have to do is put this together, and the living room looks like whatever the living room looks like, and nobody knows. You don't know that I screamed at my kids this morning, because I said, you have to go out the door to the bus, because I have to leave to work, because I have an early appointment, and I cannot stay here again with you, whatever, right? You don't know all the ways you don't do it all. Every woman, really, I would say this categorically, but okay, historians are cautious. They never say always, they never say never, because someone's going to trip you on the one example. In virtually every case, the woman you think is doing it all, only she knows where the blanket doesn't cover, right? She's pulling it up to cover her head, her toes are sticking out. She pulls it down to cover her toes, her ears are sticking out. Asking how do you do it all, or talking about women who do it all, first of all, that makes the woman you're talking about feel bad because she knows she's a total phony, she's not doing it all. It makes you feel bad because you think if she can do it, why can't I? The whole thing is not productive. The whole enterprise of these Mipha stories is not productive. Let's stop telling them. Let's stop saying, how do you do it? In that kind of Wonder Woman, how do you do it all kind of way. Let's start telling different kinds of stories and asking different kinds of questions.
Not the Michael's Wonder Worker stories, but the real life, tell me what you do to make it work. Because the real life stories are much more helpful, and in their own way, much more inspiring than the Mifus stories. So here's one real life story. When I was engaged to my husband, my sister-in-law, now Dr. Disa Berger, and her husband, now Dr. Yitzi Berger, were both working on their PhDs at the same time. And they had a bunch of little kids, and they were both working, and life looked like it looks when you're in that situation. And at some point, I went to my sister-in-law's house for Shabbos. And she said to me, come into the kitchen. I'm going to show you the secret of how two full-time working parents and two PhD students make Shabbos work. Okay, this is a good secret. I was already in graduate school then. That's a useful secret. And she walked me into the kitchen, and she showed me warming up on the blech, the Shabbos special from Wok Tov in Cedar. Because buying takeout is a real life way of telling me, here you are, you're engaged, and you now have this vision of right that perfect Shabbos. My older sister calls it official and fredel Shabbos after some children's book that was published by the Chabad publishers. I don't know, it must have been at least 30 years ago because we had these books when we were kids, written by Michal Munchik, and there were this brother and sister, official and fredel, and Friday afternoon, you know, the two freshly baked loaves of challah are on the table, and the candlesticks are freshly polished, and the house is sparkling, and mother's wearing that lace half apron, white, you know what I'm talking about thing, and going to Ben Shlich. So my older sister calls this official and fredel Shabbos. My older sister says, except there's not going to be official and fredel Shabbos. Whether that's because you're buying takeout, whether that's because you, whatever your choices are, they're going to be. And everyone's choices are going to be different. But let's tell stories about those real things. Of all the Mifus stories I dislike, the one I dislike the most intensely is about the heroic women who get by on 5, 4, 3 hours of sleep a night. Those stories are pernicious. They are destructive. I included my sources. My sources are not sources, clearly. There's no sources here like sources. My sources are readings, supplementary interesting readings. I included in my sources an interview with a professor of sleep science from Harvard University that he gave to the Harvard Business Review. You're talking about Harvard Business School as not being a warm and fuzzy place? The Harvard Business Review is not a warm and fuzzy place. About, you know, it's about maximizing your performance and everything. And he gave an interview to the Harvard Business Review in which he talks about the culture of what he calls sleepless machismo that pervades American companies. I took the red-eye flight from Singapore to, I don't know, however the farthest place on the globe you can fly from Singapore, and then I went straight into a meeting, and I pounded 17 espressos, and I this and I that. And he says, as professor of sleep science, he's talking to executives who are looking to maximize performance. It's not warm and fuzzy, no, take your me time. He says, it's all in the article, you can read it. After a few nights of 4 hours of sleep, you are functionally the equivalent of somebody whose blood alcohol level is 0.1%, which is legally drunk in the United States. That's the level at which you're functioning. He says, the old days of praising people because they could drink 3, 4, 5, whatever, martinis at lunch and still go back to the office. He holds his liquor well. He said, we no longer praise people who drink to excess as part of the workday and somehow manage not to show. He said, but we still praise people who are operating on sleep deficit, even though operating on sleep deficit has many of the same effects. I strongly encourage you to read the whole article. Does that mean we don't do it? Of course we do it sometimes because we have to. Because we have no choice. Because there's a newborn in the house, because there's a sick child in the house, because the presentation at work has to be done tomorrow. The Shabbos is at 4:09 this week, and there is no other way Shabbos is going to happen until I stay up until 2 in the morning cooking. All of those things happen. They sometimes are necessities of life. But to valorize that, to make a value of that, to make every woman who says, actually, I really need 7 hours of sleep to function, feel like she should be apologetic for that, that is not healthy in a whole range of ways, and we should cut it out. I was, the Jewish Action a few years ago, I think it was in the winter of 2012, ran a whole issue devoted to work-life balance, and they
interviewed a number of different women who are balancing work and life in a number of different ways. So the interviews themselves are very interesting and very illuminating. I was very not happy with the introduction for a few reasons. One of the reasons I was very not happy with the introduction is because the introduction says exactly this. How do they do it? One of the ways these superwomen do it, I actually might have copied that and put that in here. One of the ways these superwomen do it is because they've all gotten used to getting by on less sleep. All sleep scientists will tell you there really aren't people who need less sleep, meaning, you know, some people need 7, some people need 9, but there aren't people who need 4. There are just people who are making themselves get by on 4 and operating at the level of impairment that breaks. So do we have to do it sometimes? We have to do it. We should stop valorizing it. We should stop making it a virtue. And we should stop making people who are giving in to the normal physiological need for sleep feel bad any more than we make people who give in to the normal physiological need for food feel bad, although that's probably a bad comparison because sometimes we do that also. So that's the first thing I want to say. The first thing I want to say is stop telling MIFAS stories, especially stop telling MIFAS stories about people who don't sleep. Stop assuming that someone else has the secret and she's doing it all. No one else has the secret, I promise you. No one else. Okay, maybe there's someone somewhere. It could be there's one woman somewhere. Basically, no one has the secret and no one's doing it all. And when you see a woman who you think is doing it all, instead of saying, oh my gosh, you're amazing, I don't know how you do it, say to her, tell me, give me a practical tip. Tell me how you do it. Because a lot of women are going to say to you, here's what I traded off. Here's what I gave up. Here's what I had to accommodate on. You know, I don't cook. Or I cook, but I don't go to PTA meetings. I call my kids teachers. Or I cook and I go to PTA meetings, but I don't go to weddings because I don't have time for weddings. Or whatever the ors are, it can go on all day. And that's much more helpful than telling, you know, fake Wonder Worker stories. The next thing I want to say, and it jumps off of this, and this is the part that is our obligation to ourselves, and the final part that's our obligation to others. The sisterhood is powerful for it, and then we'll open up the floor to whatever anyone wants to say. Our obligation to ourselves, once we acknowledge that we are asking of ourselves the impossible, once we acknowledge that no one else is doing it either, then our obligation to ourselves is to decide what we will do, what we will not do, to own those choices, to be a big girl and say, I am taking responsibility for the choices I have made, and not to let casual conversation with someone else in the carpool line, with someone else in the park on Shabbos afternoon, with someone else, wherever we talk to someone else, throw us off and guilt us and make us feel like we're no good, we're failing, we're falling short. No one can do it all. I have made my choices about what I am doing. I will own those choices. You choose something else, bully for you. So here we go. My mother is a high school principal in Brooklyn, has been involved in girls' clinic for upwards of 40 years, says a lot of smart things. And one of the smart things she says is peer pressure is us. Peer pressure is us. By and large, there is not a coordinated group of mean girls in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and beyond trying to make us feel bad about our choices. And if you know such a mean girl, if she is in your life, I would strongly suggest you start avoiding her like the plague because there is not enough emotional energy in the world to deal with someone who's trying to make you feel bad about yourself. But basically, that's not what we're dealing with. We're just dealing with other people who tell us about their choices that are different from our own. And then we ourselves say, oh, she's doing that. I should be doing that. I feel bad that I'm not doing that. Peer pressure is us. So we can decide to, no. That's what you do? Bully for you. Fabulous. I'm so happy for you. It's not my choices. So here's what I wrote. Oh, I only give my kids organic. No, she's never had a bottle. No matter what, she's in bed by 7 every night. I never use paper on the Shabbos table. I can't go to sleep at night with dirty dishes in the sink. I try to learn something every Shabbos afternoon. I have guests every Shabbos. I'm really not the same person if I don't exercise, so I get up at 5:30 every morning to go walking.
My husband davens vasikin every Shabbos so that I can get to shul too. My Shabbos isn't the same without it. I only let my kids have Honey Nut Cheerios on Shabbos. I've had 5 children without an epidural. Well, mice eat gummy worms. They have bottles and pacifiers, and they suck their thumbs. They go to sleep at 11:30 on late Friday nights and Yom Tov nights. I never use anything but paper on my Shabbos table, and not the fancy paper from Costco either. I couldn't bear to have a stranger see what I or my house looks like by the time we stagger into Shabbos. I think Honey Nut Cheerios are health food. I go to sleep with dirty dishes, I wake up with dirty dishes, I go to work with dirty dishes, and I come back to the dirty dishes the next evening. I'd love to exercise because I'd love to lose those last 5 pounds from the last baby and the last 5 pounds from the baby before that, but I need every precious second of sleep I can get. I haven't been to shul on Shabbos since my first kid was born, and I probably won't be back until my youngest is 6. I haven't opened a sefer in approximately the same time frame. I think I was traumatized by that disastrous time during Shana Rishona when my husband decided that we should learn together. Epic fail. I've had 5 kids, and they couldn't get that needle into my back fast enough.
None of these is the right or wrong answer. Every one of these is a choice.
Different ones of us will make different choices. You'll use china on the Shabbos table, but you'll give your kids gummy worms. You'll only eat organic, but you'll let your kid have a pacifier or your bottle feed. Whatever your combination is, it's your choice, and that's fine. Whatever's working for you and for your family, and that's fine. And own that choice and be a big girl about it. And when somebody else says, oh, you give your baby a bottle, I only breastfeed, recognize that that's not a judgment, mostly. That's just the, yeah, oh, you, and it's, you have to be able to say, great, that's fantastic. I'm so happy that works for you. And not go home racked with guilt. And not, again, leaving out the rare person who's actually trying to make you feel bad about yourself, in which case run like the Dickens and don't go back. But other than that, that's not what we're dealing with. We're dealing with people who are telling you about their lives and you're talking about your life, and okay. And okay, and be able to say, that's so nice for you. So happy that works for you. Not the way we do things. Fantastic. Lovely.
Enjoy your time on your Shabbos table. My kids are enjoying their gummy worms.
I think the more that we can do that, the more that we accept that we aren't going to be able to do everything, therefore we accept we're going to make choices about what we do, and everyone else's choices are going to be different than our choices, and we can hear about their choices without hearing implicit judgment of our choices, and we can hear about their choices without guilt, then we can be more realistically part of a conversation that says, I do what I do, you do what you do, we're all making it work in different ways, with different trade-offs, with different... And I don't have to feel bad because I hear you do something different. The last thing I want to say, and this goes beyond us as individuals, our families, individual families, and this speaks to the sisterhood is powerful point, is what do we do? I've talked about what we do ourselves to not feel guilty, to not feel bad, to not carry that around with us. What do we do to try not to contribute to a climate of other women feeling bad about their choices? So I have a set in stone, carved out of rock, absolute, hard and fast rule, the teeny tiny little exception. And that is, do not give advice. Alan Sherman, don't give advice. Alan Sherman, who's a songwriter, he's famous for the song Hello Mata, Hello Fada, you know Hello Mata, Hello Fada, I'm current Campanada. He has another song that everybody should be forced to listen to. It's called Good Advice, and the chorus goes, good advice, good advice. Good advice costs nothing, and it's worth the price. Okay? When you say to your friend, oh, have you tried? Oh, did you, she's living her life, she's doing her thing, her kids are her kids, her job is her job, her everything is her everything. Not yours, you don't know, helpful suggestions are not helpful. Here is my tiny little loophole, and it is so tiny that it's the eye of a needle. Well, if she asks you for advice, you can give advice. If a younger sister, if a very close friend says, I'm having this difficult time with my career, with my family, with my balance, with my husband, with my kids, with whatever, what do you think I should do? So then she's inviting you into the conversation, she wants to hear what you think. Other than that, my teeny tiny loophole, and it is very important that you not expand that, is if you really think you see somebody doing something which is
Terrible.
Dangerous. Actively detrimental to the physical or you know, long-term health of our kids. But that's a very small loophole, because it's very easy to expand that loophole and to say, well, I think, you know, my daughter is not raising her kids right, and if I just give her this helpful advice, she's an adult. Your son-in-law is an adult. They're going to make their choices. They're going to make their mistakes. They're going to do things the way they do. They're probably not going to take your advice anyway. They're not going to be helped by it. They're just going to resent it. And the real truth also is, as I said all the way in the beginning when I started, unless you're in it and you're in it the particular way they're in it, it's a little hard to know, it's a little hard to guess, it's a little hard to gauge. I know when you had kids, they didn't get tested for different kinds of therapies and different kinds of early interventions and start physical therapy or speech therapy or whatever it was when they were 2 or 3. Is every single one of those interventions necessary? Probably not. Is the mother of a kid who's just been evaluated as being low tone and told that her child needs to go to physical therapy or to OT, does that mother want to hear from mommy or mommy-in-law or grandmother or grandma-in-law, low tone? What kind of nonsense is low tone? We didn't have low tone when I was a kid. What are you wasting your time on? This is what she heard from her physician. This is what she heard from the experts she's trusting. This is what she's going to do. And absent something that's really, again, dangerous for, even if it's really dangerous, she may not listen to you, right? You know, if your kids aren't vaccinating and are potentially exposing your kids to whooping cough and measles, you can talk to them about it, but they're probably very committed to their path of not vaccinating. They're not going to listen to you anyway. But advice, stepping into somebody else's life and somebody else's circumstances and somebody else's choices and somebody else's compromises, without knowing everything about that, is likely to be, first of all, again, it's just likely not to be listened to. So just at the very basic level, it's likely not to be listened to. But it's also likely not to be helpful, and it potentially can be worse than not helpful, okay? A parent struggling with a child with significant emotional health issues is not helped by your saying, well, you know, I think if you didn't work and if you stayed home with the child wouldn't have significant emotional health. First of all, the parent may very well not have a choice to do that. Second of all, the parent probably knows a lot more about the emotional health issues of the child than you do, even if you are the child's grandmother or aunt or mother's best friend or whatever your position might be. And there's very little about that advice that's probably going to contribute. Again, there are a few exceptions to this. One is if you're asked for it, and the other is if you really think that something actively dangerous is going on, although even there I can't tell you'll be listened to. But other than that, I think we should be able to listen and hear and say, I feel for you, that sounds like it's rough, without saying, you know what you could do that would fix your whole problem. Because very often that you know what you could do and you can fix your whole problem imposes on somebody else a burden of guilt, a demand they can't meet, a lack of acknowledging the realities of their lives. It's just not helpful. And what we should be doing at this point, I think, is being as helpful to each other as we can be. So a 30-second recap, and then no one's coming in after us, so we can stay with questions. 30-second recap first. 30-second recap. We are asking of ourselves the impossible. If the women out there in the world think it's impossible, if the Deborah Spars and the Naomi Wolfs and everybody else think it's impossible, and they, again, are doing it with many fewer demands being thrown into the hopper than we are, then kal vachomer, for from women, the nature of the demands are impossible. We have to understand that, and that means we have to forgive ourselves and pardon ourselves our choices. We have to understand that no one else is doing it either, and stop pretending that somebody is. Don't look for the magic trick that's going to make it possible. There's no magic trick. Work on the strategies. Think about what makes sense for you and your family. Make the choices that make sense for you and your family. Own those choices, be comfortable with those choices. Be ready to smilingly shrug off other people's choices that are different than yours. And create a climate, a community, a culture of women that is supportive of women and their different choices of how to get it done, rather than, as Deborah Spar talks about, subtly mocking other people who can't get it done because it makes us feel better than not getting it done. Don't offer advice unless you're asked for it. Understand you don't know what's going on inside someone's life, home, choices. And then this doesn't solve the problem because it doesn't make the problem go away. But maybe it helps us be emotionally healthier
and happier people as we deal with some of these issues and get sleep. Yes. I'll repeat the question. So what if it doesn't work anyway, and how do you help her be able to cope? The answer is going to be different depending on where you are and what position you are in the help. If you are in a position to meaningfully help, right? If this is your daughter or your daughter-in-law, and you know that throwing a lot of money at the problem doesn't always solve a problem, but sometimes throwing a lot of money at the problem does solve a problem. And you can throw a lot of money at the problem, go ahead and throw it, right? I think you need right now, this child needs you to take a year off from work, and I'm going to underwrite that. If that's not something you're in a position to do, or it's not your daughter, it's your sister, you can't say that to her, or it's your best friend, sometimes you can't make it all work, right? Because you can't make it all work. There are big problems in the world, the problems you can't solve. Sometimes you can say to somebody, well, I really feel for you. Sometimes you can say to somebody, I'm coming over to your house tonight for 2 hours, go out and clear your head. I know this doesn't solve the big problems, it doesn't address anything. But right now, take 2 hours out and go clear your head. I'm buying pizza for your kids tonight. Just go out and take 2 hours. I don't pretend this is going to solve the big problems in life. When you really have young children who need complete hands-on care, and perhaps also an older parent who needs a lot of care and attention, and you're working and you are ripped, torn, pulled in between that, we're not going to solve that problem. But you don't have to layer on top of that the guilt that I bought Shabbos or my kid. You know, I've been talking to a lot of people about this as I'm preparing to talk about it. My sisters, friends, a lot of people who are living this in different ways. And my oldest sister said, there's a lot of stuff that you can push off and it's fine. Deborah Svar actually talks about this in her book. It's a concept coming from economics called satisficing. And satisficing basically means figuring out what's good enough that you could live with, like when second best or third best or whatever best is good enough. My older sister says, you know what, nothing's going to happen if the kid's well because it doesn't happen for another month. Nothing's going to happen if the 6-month dental checkup happens at 8 months or a year. Just like a kid into the dentist, lifted a chart, hasn't been seen by dentist for a year and a half, maybe. There are things in life that we can say, this we're gonna let go of, b'shalom u'bracha, not I'm going to let go of and kick myself about it all the time. And the bigger the problems are you have to deal with, the more you're going to let go of. And there have been times in life when, you know, people have had to let go of pretty big things because the size of the issue that needed addressing. So I don't pretend that these small ball fixes fix everything, but I think they help shape a culture in which we're not beating ourselves up, and we're not sometimes we're looking to elevate other people to the perfect people who've done it all even though they haven't, and other times we're looking to beat people down to make us feel better that we're not doing it all either, neither of which contributes to healthy culture. I will end here and let you go to your Danish, but if anybody would like to keep talking, I'm happy to stay and keep talking.